This is Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.
Hi, this is Bob Johnston, and you're listening to Being Catholic right here on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5 FM in McLean County, 92.5 in Bloomington Normal, 97.1 in Lincoln, 88.3 in Pontiac. We're going to have a great show for you today. I'm here with my wife, Lynn. She is back, so we're very glad about that. Lynn will say hello and have a few words for you in a minute or two. I did want to mention, priestly vocation ride, where they usually ride all, the whole diocese all the way from Rock Island to down in south east of the diocese on the Indiana line. There were a lot of great pictures in the Post. If you haven't seen that, go ahead and get the Post and be sure to read it. And a great story all about, you know, what's going on. And we certainly do need vocations, so we're very, very glad that they do things like that. And I'm sure it was a great ride again this year. And also, Spirit Radio had a trip up to the Holocaust Museum, as we've mentioned before. And there were some pictures in the Post about that, too. So make sure you do get the Post and check out those things. There's a lot of good information there as well. If you're Catholics out there, you should try to read as much as you can about Catholicism, subscribe to the Post, and be interested in the bulletins and all of the various things that are going on. And we here at Catholic Spirit Radio try to get as much of that in as we possibly can. And sometimes we might miss something. If anybody out there has something you would like us to talk about or introduce, make sure you let us know. You can go to our website, CatholicSpiritRadio.com. Again, that's CatholicSpiritRadio.com. And you can find out a lot about us there. And that will give you information, and it will tell you how to contact us, and you can email us. You can call us also at 309-807-2427. And don't forget, we always need donations. We're brought to you by you, and so we're a listener-supported station, and we depend on you. And if you like our shows and what we do, and you want to help support us, please send whatever you can. We would very much appreciate it. And I'll turn this over for a minute or two to my wife, Lynn, and she can talk a little bit. We're going to talk again about literature today, and I'll get back into that when we come back. So, Lynn, go ahead and say hello.
Oh, hello, everybody out there. Glad to be back. It's been kind of a rough first 2 weeks, pretty rough after having a shoulder replacement. And, you know, I kind of related it when things were kind of bad. You know, I wondered how Jesus must have felt hanging on the cross, my God, stretching his shoulders out and just hanging like that and the pain that it's deep in the bone. It really related to that, related that to it. And offered that up for the poor souls, and poor souls here on earth, too, because we've got enough of them. But things are on the mend. Everything went textbook, according to the surgeon, and nothing but up from here. My daughter's been helping out. Bob's been trying to, I've been driving him crazy. Little things I don't, you know, we all do things differently, and I have my own way of doing things. Well, patience is something I don't have a lot of.
That's something that both of us need to work on. But yeah, it's true. When you're trying to do something and somebody is standing over there telling you that everything that you're doing is the wrong way to do it.
Feel like throwing something at them. Right. I know I do.
You say, who's doing this, me or you? You know, you want to do it?
Yeah, I do, but I can't. Yeah. But I'm glad to be back and on the mend. And hopefully we can keep going for quite a long time. We've got a lot of things we're planning here at the station, and I'd like to be more involved. So this should pave the way.
And you know that one.
Oh, and I wanted to say thank everybody for their prayers. I've had people praying for me, and it's been wonderful. There is a difference. You know when people are praying for you. It helps.
And, you know, your point there about, you know, Jesus on the cross and the pain you were suffering, that's the one thing about Christianity, and especially Catholic Christianity, is the idea that you can offer up your suffering, you know, as a gift to Christ, to God, and offer it up just as Christ did, and that it's meaningful.
Right.
And, you know, that's David Anders says so much. That's, his wife came back to the Catholic Church. Because they had gone through some hard times and so forth. David Anders, of course, is one of the on EWTN. you know,
called a communion.
Personalities who has a radio show called a communion. You can listen to it on Catholic Spirit Radio every afternoon at 1 o'clock during the week. And I think it comes on at 10 o'clock in the evenings as a repeat. But the idea that you can offer that up and that it's meaningful. And there, in the secular world, there is no explanation for suffering. You know, there's this almost idea that somehow we should be able to overcome it. And there's this almost chip on the shoulder attack on and pointing out of whenever there's suffering, why is it, and so forth. And there's no explanation. And the Christian approach does give an explanation of suffering, and it can be something that is actually can transform us and bring us to a better stage in life. I don't want to get in and sing paeans of suffering. It doesn't mean that it's fun, but it means that it can be meaningful, and I think that's
right.
Important.
And, you know, it helps if you feel something is worth going through or doing. It really makes a difference in your whole attitude. And I think that's one thing that the Catholic Church has really reinforced, and I think it's good.
Exactly. I think some of them, you know, not everybody, but some, I think, of our Protestant friends have lost that idea that, you know, suffering is a meaningful thing.
Yeah, or it's a punishment.
Yeah, like it's some kind of a punishment that if you're right with God, you shouldn't suffer. But that's not the case. So.
No, it's not.
At any rate, last week we were talking about Shakespeare, and I got into that a little bit more than the book that we're doing, Literature by Joseph Pierce, What Every Catholic Should Know, you know, a little bit more than that book called for, because Pierce keeps everything very, very compact, and I expanded on Shade. The reason I did it is I wanted to point out how much persecution Catholics suffered during the Elizabethan period. You know, in England, and also, of course, in certain parts of Europe under Lutheran or, you know, under Calvin and that kind of thing. And it is important to know that. So that's why I dwelt on it. But we're going to talk a little bit today. We're going to move on, and we're going to talk about Cervantes, who lived at the same time as Shakespeare. And he wrote, of course, the one great book that he wrote, and that is Don Quixote. And actually, people don't realize that Don Quixote is probably the best-selling piece of literature in the world, that it outsold just about everything, probably not the Bible, but actually outsold Shakespeare and many, many other writers and many, many popular things that we even have today, you know, if you take it in absolute numbers throughout the world.
So I really hadn't realized that. That would surprise me. I never would have thought.
And he's been a huge influence on a lot. We'll talk about the influence of Cervantes on Mark Twain, for example, and Huckleberry Finn a little bit. Pierce doesn't really get into that, and he doesn't really incorporate Mark Twain's writing into his later on here when he talks about a modern American literature, because obviously in a book like this, he can't do everything. He has to pare it down. But I'm going to compare that a little bit to Mark Twain because Huckleberry Finn, you know, incorporates so much of what's in Cervantes. So we'll get to that. But we'll just start out here from Joseph Pierce's book, Literature, What Every Catholic Should Know. And I would really strongly recommend that people read this book if you want to know about literature. And you can do it, you know, very, very entertainingly and very in a compact manner, about 200 pages covering all the way from Homer up to modern American literature. Some of the best, and without getting into it and, you know, struggling through long pieces of reading and so forth. At any rate, we'll start out with a poem, a part of a poem here, Lepanto by G.K. Chesterton. And it says here, and I want to mention when Cervantes lived before we start, his time was about around the same time as Shakespeare. It was from 1547 to 1616, the same exact year Shakespeare died. Cervantes, on his galley, sets the sword back in the sheath. Don John of Austria rides homeward with a wreath. And he sees across a weary land a straggling road in Spain, up which a lean and foolish knight forever rides in vain. And he smiles, but not as sultans smile, and settles back the blade. And that was G.K. Chesterton, and he's writing about Lepanto, the Battle of Lepanto, in which the Christian forces defeated Islam and drove Islam out of Europe all the way until this day. And it turned the tide and stopped the Islamic forces from taking over all of Europe. And Cervantes was very aware of this, of course, because his own country, Spain, had thrown out the Islam, the Muslims, in 1492. It was about 1571 that the Battle of Lepanto took place, and Cervantes was part of that battle. For the actually survival of Western civilization depended on that battle, and it's a great poem by G.K. Chesterton. If you ever have a chance, read it. Because to this day, more people should know about it, because our whole civilization, all of Western Europe, the United States and everything, depended on that battle. Had the Christian forces lost, Europe probably would have been overrun by Islam, and Christianity probably would have been destroyed. But
right,
it didn't
and that
happen.
Happened in October, and it's often, you know, it is recognized that that was a very, very decisive battle. In the end of the Muslim incursion into Europe.
Exactly.
And Our Lady of the Rosary has a lot to do with that, which we celebrate, I believe it's this weekend.
Yes, they prayed the Rosary. The Christian forces were vastly outnumbered, but they prevailed because they had better technology, they had better ships, they had better ocean-going ships and so forth. And we need to understand that the Crusades and that the battle against Islam was not some kind of aggressive army of Christians going into Muslims' countries and attacking them for our own gain. It was a defense. You take a look at, I've said it before, if you look at the Mediterranean in early Christianity, you know, at the time of the fall of Rome, all of those countries were Christian. And you look at most of them today, they're not. And that didn't happen by accident. It didn't happen because the Christians picked up and left or became Muslim. It happened because Muslim forces battled their way into those countries and took them over, and they were moving northward. They raided as far north as Iceland and took slaves. They took far more slaves than any Christians ever took African slaves, believe me. There were far more Christian slaves, and they died over the years without leaving a trace or any legacy whatsoever. So we need to understand that.
Yes, I think perhaps when teaching history, that's very much overlooked. I don't know if we have too much to teach in history anymore, but they streamline it to the point where you really miss out on some very important cues and things that are that have preceded us.
There's too much political correctness in history. It needs to be changed. There's somehow this idea got ingrained. It was the West that has done everything wrong. Not true. At any rate,
you know, it wasn't just the incursion into the Crusades were fought because Muslims were imposing their viewpoint by the sword, really, into Europe.
Exactly.
And then this was a reaction, not the other way around, that the Crusades caused all the bad feelings. That's not true.
That's true. Were there incidents, of course, on both sides where there were things done that were wrong? Absolutely, because war always brings that on. You're not going to have a war in which those kinds of things don't happen. But to try and stress that that's all on one side and not the other, and to try and stress the whole war and something was turned on different tables than it really turned on, that is a distortion of history.
Right. And one thing I might point out to you, Chesterton is a fairly recent English writer. He's not from the 1400s at all.
No, no, not at all.
He just died, what, in 36, 37, right, somewhere in there, 1937.
But he was a great Catholic, as we know, a convert, of course, and had a very difficult time. You know, it was not that long after the persecution in English ended, when you really think about it, that there was still a lot of anti-Catholicism there, and still is to this day, but even more in Chesterton's day, and yet he became a Catholic. And there had something to do with that, you know, in other words, suffering being something that can be beneficial. And he even said, when people asked him, you know, why did you ever become a Catholic, he would say with a little bit of a smile on his face, sort of half in jest, but pretty darn serious too. He said, I became a Catholic so I could get my sins forgiven. And people sort of snickered at that a little bit, thinking that he was just kidding. But then they could look at his face and see he wasn't just kidding either.
That's right.
In other words, they knew it was there was a serious core to that. At any rate, we digress a little bit, so we will get back. It says here, in his marvelous poem Lepanto, G.K. Chesterton imagined a great Spanish writer, Miguel de Cervantes, setting his sword back in his sheath and smiling contentedly after he has played his part in the historic victory of the Christian fleet over its Turkish foe, meaning Muslims, Islam, at the Battle of Lepanto. Chester concluded his poem with these lines as a way of showing that the victory was crucial to the survival of Christendom, and its cultural fruits epitomized and symbolized by Cervantes' classic novel, Don Quixote, about a lean and foolish knight who forever rides in vain. Chesterton's point was that Christendom might have been destroyed and overrun by the forces of Islam had not the Christian fleet prevailed, in which case works such as those of Cervantes, and indeed of Chesterton himself, would never have been written or published. So our whole Christian history and the whole history of Western civilization hinged on this battle especially, you know, and of course other battles, you know, that preceded it, because it was touch and go all the way. And we should know more about that Battle of Lepanto. We should know more also about the very, you know, not that long before that, the ejection of the Muslims, you know, Islam from Spain in 1492, and then made it possible for Columbus, of course, to sail across and explore the West and bring Christianity to the West. And, of course, Columbus today among the liberal set is seen no more as a hero.
A conqueror.
Yeah, as if somehow or another he went over and conquered some kind, he went over and brought troubles and evil and so forth to a group of people who were sort of rusticating in the Americas and in the islands and were nice and peaceful until the nasty Westerners got there. None of that is true. In fact, actually, the island that Columbus first landed on, the people that were living there had conquered that island only about 10 years before, and they had killed and kicked out the people that had been living there. I mean, there were wars going on here, diseases going on here. The people living here, the Native Americans that we call Indians today and so forth, were not some kind of innocent people just sitting there rusticating. They were human beings like everybody else, and they suffered from the same problems and the fall and so forth that all of us did. But at any rate, we're digressing, and I'll get back to the regular text here in just a minute. But we're going to take a break right now, so stay with us. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.
One of the great teachings of Jesus from the Sermon on the Mount is, "Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy." St. Augustine was a doctor of the Church, and his classic, City of God, speaks to the ongoing battle between this world and God's world. He points to the sermon as the way to heavenly perfection. He likened each of us to beggars on God's doorstep and reminded us that as we treat our beggars, so God will treat us, his beggars. Often, we struggle with the ways of the world. Others may do things to us out of competition. They may slight us or injure our egos. Instead of being hard, be generous in giving out mercy. Look ahead to a God that invites us through the doorstep of his heavenly perfection of his world. This has been a bit of Catholic encouragement from Michael Cesondi.
Hi, this is Bob Johnston. You're listening to Being Catholic right here on Catholic Spirit Radio. We're back from our break. We're talking about literature, What Every Catholic Should Know by Joseph Pierce. And from that book, we're reading about Miguel de Cervantes, a Spanish writer who wrote Don Quixote. And we were talking about the fact that Cervantes fought in the Battle of Lepanto, which was a battle of Christians against the Muslims, against the Turkish Muslims, Islam. and a battle which the Western civilization depended on. If it was lost, all of Western civilization easily could have been lost. And so it was very, very important. And Miguel de Cervantes fought heroically at Lepanto, receiving a serious wound to his left hand, which he would wear as a badge of honor for the remainder of his life, as well as he might. Born in Spain in 1547, Cervantes' early life reads like a swashbuckling adventure story. Having fought at Lepanto in 1571, he was captured by Barbary pirates, and the Barbary pirates, of course, were Muslims, and later on in the 1700s, of course, the United States was also involved with the battles against the Barbary pirates. They were attacking United States ships. And the president at that time, Thomas Jefferson, sent the Marines, you know, against the Barbary pirates. And you have it in the Marines hymn today, from the halls of Montezuma, you know, to the shores of Tripoli. Right. We were fighting. That battle was the battle against Barbary pirates. They were still there. And they took prisoners and so forth, and they ransomed them and that kind of thing. He was captured by Barbary pirates 4 years later and imprisoned for 5 years, making several daring escape attempts before finally being rescued by the Trinitarian friars in 1580. So there were a lot of religious who were fighting in various battles with the Christian Crusades and, you know, all the way up into 1580s. In fact, there were battles up into the 1600s, you know, again, with the Lepanto. At any rate, thereafter, his life became uneventful, marked only by his frustrated attempts to make a name for himself as a writer and a playwright. By the time that he finally attained success with the publication of the first part of Don Quixote in 1605, he was 58 years old. Mm. The second part would appear 10 years later, a year after his death. So he wrote half of it, and then 10 years later, the other half finally appeared, actually a year after his death. Cervantes was therefore a late bloomer and what might be called a one-hit wonder, his other works being largely unsuccessful during his own lifetime and largely forgotten today. If, however, Cervantes can only claim one literary classic to his name, as distinct from the dozens of classics written by his great contemporary Shakespeare, he can claim to have written the most successful work of literature in the history of the world, at least in terms of global sales. It is generally accepted that Don Quixote is the all-time bestseller, outselling its nearest rivals, A Tale of Two Cities by Dickens, and The Lord of the Rings by Tolkien. As for its literary merit, we can trust the view of Maurice Baring, a fine writer who was himself the finest of critics, that no book has such a good beginning as Don Quixote, and no book has a finer end. But I find that, you know, just imagine outselling The Lord of the Rings. Imagine, you know, how popular The Lord of the Rings became. Way back in the 60s, it became extremely popular on college campuses. And then, of course, what was it, in the about around 2000, right in that area, early part of the 21st century, it became made into movies and that kind of thing. So, I mean, it's hard to imagine that Don Quixote would be more popular than that, but it was.
Right. That was, like I said earlier, that really surprised me.
Yeah. It says here, you know, Pierce asks, so what makes Don Quixote so special? First, if not necessarily foremost, it was a first of its kind, arguably the first novel ever written, the progenitor of a whole new literary form. And because the novel is relatively recent, you know, when you consider literature itself, I mean, compared to how far back you can go from before the novel. Most literature was poetic, and the novel was something new and different. Even before the novel, there were the development, you know, around the novel. Later, there was the development of short stories, too. It is full of exciting action and is driven by the unlikely friendship of Don Quixote and his servant and traveling companion, Sancho Panza. the latter's almost cynical, no-nonsense realism serving as an intellectual foil to Quixote's manically romantic fantasizing. At the novel's heart is the evident desire of Cervantes to satirize and lampoon the popular books of chivalry, the Libros de Calabarias, which were the pulp fiction of the day. This has been seen by some as evidence of a deep-seated cynicism, or at least an anti-romanticism on Cervantes' part. And I want to stop here and mention, you know, the Don Quixote being the picaresque hero. This is what Quixote, this is a Spanish term, picaresque meaning a colorful person on a quest who travels from place to place and sort of sometimes a comic figure. And this is, of course, describes Don Quixote. But there's another one in American literature, a very, very classic picaresque hero who is very colorful but not quite so humorous or funny as Don Quixote was. Do you know who that is, Lynn? What author am I talking about
you're
here?
You're talking about Mark Twain's, one of his boys that he wrote about, not Tom, but...
Huckleberry?
Yeah, Huckleberry Finn.
Huckleberry Finn. Huckleberry Finn is a picaresque novel, and it has a lot of, you know, what Cervantes laid down for a picaresque hero. Huck Finn is a picaresque hero. Huck Finn, of course, though, is not silly, and Huck Finn is not romantic at all like Don Quixote.
No, he's a realist.
Huck Finn is a realist, and in Huck Finn, if there's a foil at all, it would be Tom Sawyer or Mark Twain himself would be the foils. They would be the romantic people. And when I'm using romantic here, the people that sometimes believe in sort of a fantasy that is not quite real and a picture of the world as it is. Huck saw the world as he travels down the Mississippi River, and you see all kinds of characters and types representing the type, but, you know, a whole cross-section of America, good, bad, ugly. You know, you might want to put that down. And Huck sees these people with a very accurate realism, a very plain realism. And Huck himself is sort of colorful and so forth, but he's not at all a romantic figure. And, of course, Huck is on a quest. He's on a quest to free Jim, the Negro slave that Huck is that has teamed up with Huck. And I can't get into all of that, but the point is that there is a huge influence in Mark Twain from Cervantes, and we should know and understand it because that novel, Huck Finn, and the one thing we need to understand about Huck Finn is that Huck Finn is a classic because it was written for all time. You have to remember that Huck Finn was opposed by the conservative forces at the time that Mark Twain wrote. In other words, or at the time that Huck Finn is set in, at least. Huck Finn is set when slavery is still going on, and because Huck Finn is helping a Negro slave to escape, Huck Finn is an anti-hero, you know, a non-hero, according to the contemporary forces of his day, and he's eluding those forces. And so Huck Finn was, you know, to those forces, not a heroic figure at all. And to the liberals of that time, Huck Finn was a hero, because they were opposed to slavery, if you want to put it in those terms. But today, Huck Finn is still opposed and hated, and now he's hated by the liberals of today.
You know, right.
And perhaps
what
loved,
a flip-flop.
And perhaps loved by the so-called conservatives. Huck Finn hasn't changed, but our culture sure has.
Yes.
You know,
it's quite a flip, too,
right,
when you think about it.
What was heroic yesterday is not heroic today, and what was evil yesterday is not evil today, and so on. It's just a total flip-flop. But poor Huck, he can't find a time in which he's loved, you know, by the ordinary forces of the day.
I wonder if that doesn't apply to a lot of us who are realists, that you just don't, you're kind of counter-cultural.
Right, exactly. Strangely enough, Huck would be considered a racist today. I mean, this is how far. And this is we can't get into it today, but this is a problem with our whole concept of rights not being balanced, you know, being right. one-sided. Because when a virtue is one-sided, when you take a virtue and you extol it, you know, to the exclusion of other virtues, not balanced by other virtues, it becomes a horrible vice. And that's the problem with a system of rights in which there are no checks on those rights, in which there are no, you know, virtues that restrict and put those rights in their proper places. So that's why this whole concept dreamed up by John Locke and Thomas Hobbes and some of the others has some huge flaws that need to be corrected, and why we go from one swing to another. The pendulum swings from one side to the other, wildly out of control. So I'd like to really could digress here and talk a little bit about Ayn Rand's novel Anthem. Gives an example of that, going from one extreme to another, from, you know, people who are from a monstrous collective, you know, that suppresses the individual I and becomes a monstrous collective I, you know, not an ego, it all the way to the other extreme when each individual becomes a monstrous egotistical I. And I think now we are reaching this other extreme when each individual becomes some kind of an autonomous soul and there's no constraint on these out of whack and out of control so-called virtues. But that's getting into another subject, I guess.
Right. It is totally, yeah. But it's pretty interesting as I'm concerned.
But literature can do that for you. Uh-huh. You can look at literature and you can sit there, and especially when you read and you look at it and you can see, you know, all of these things and analyze them and think about them and talk about them. And great literature tells a great story, and because we are all in a story. That's why we love stories. And that's why I think the world was in love with Don Quixote. It's a great story.
Right.
And by that story, we learn. And that's how we learn in life. Our life is a story, and we learn from it, but we can learn more if we have the time to sit down and look at that story, you know, objectively and calmly and through, you know, the eyes of an author relating it to us. So it's a great way to learn.
You know, and you look at it, there's nothing like holding a book in your hand. You own that book while you have it, and you've got it in your hand. And it, you sit down, and you get lost in the world of the story and so forth, and time slows down for you. Today, you get a tablet or an iPhone, and you're reading, and you're forever getting messages with that somebody else is trying to get a hold of you. How can you concentrate?
At any rate,
so that's another diversion.
But we'll come back.
Go ahead, I'm back.
We'll come back to Cervantes here and Don Quixote.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go on.
All right.
Lord Byron, for instance, we talked about at the novel's heart is the evident desire of Cervantes to satirize and lampoon the popular books of chivalry. And, of course, these popular books of chivalry don't represent the real chivalry that took place before that. They were books that took this chivalry to extremes and made it into something it really wasn't. But Lord Byron, for instance, in his poem Don Juan, and not Don Juan, Byron makes you say Don Juan. Byron says, I need a hero, and I can't find a new one, so I'll just use my old friend Don Juan. You have to say Juan. Byron makes you say it. So the Byron is having a little bit of fun with Knight's Errant himself here. And so it's spelled J-U-A-N and pronounced Juan, of course, but Byron makes you say Juan. I need a hero, can't find a new one, so I'll use my old friend Don Juan. But
Byron
anyhow,
was an English poet.
Exactly. And Lord Byron, for instance, in his poem Don Juan, complained that Don Quixote had illustrated that it was futile to attempt to redress men's wrongs and rather check than punish crimes, because Cervantes, in his too true tale, had shown how all such efforts fail. To paraphrase Byron's critique of Don Quixote, he says that the novel shows that the life of virtue pursued by Quixote is nothing but a facile and futile fantasy, signifying nothing, thereby turning the truths of reason as embodied in Greek philosophy into nonsense. making of Socrates a figure similar to Don Quixote himself, nothing but wisdom's fool, one whose wisdom is mere foolishness. According to Byron, Cervantes had used Don Quixote to laugh scornfully at virtue, seducing us to laugh with him, thereby destroying the whole Spanish history of chivalry and shaking the very foundations of faith and reason. For Byron, therefore, Don Quixote is nothing less than an iconoclastic attack on civilization itself. Strong words indeed. In similar, if not such strident fashion, the great Russian novelist Dostoevsky recorded in his diary that Don Quixote was, quote, the saddest book ever written, because it is a story of disillusionment. And yet, in a letter to his niece, Dostoevsky went much deeper, stating that of all the beautiful individuals in Christian literature, one stands out as the most perfect, Don Quixote, adding by way of paradox that he is beautiful only because he is ridiculous. He then gets to the mystical and mysterious heart of the novel. Whenever compassion toward ridiculed and ingenious beauty is presented, the reader's sympathy is aroused. The mystery of human humor lies in this excitation of compassion. Dostoevsky wrote these words as he was beginning to create the chaotic character of Prince Myshkin, the protagonist of his novel, The Idiot, who is clearly inspired by Don Quixote and indeed modeled on him. Now, is all of this true? Is Byron's criticism here true? Is Dostoevsky's criticism here on the mark? You know, this is something we're going to check when we come back from our break and find out. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.
You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden. Does one light a lamp and put it under a basket? Let your light shine so that all may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. Matthew chapter 5. One mom at my daughter's school always had a cheerful smile on her face. Whether seeing her dropping off a bunch of kids or out on the playground with them, there was always a glow about her. One day I bumped into her at the store. As she was leaving with a bag of groceries, she gave a warm hello, and we chatted. She spoke of visiting a parishioner who had just lost a son to an accident. How sad. Yes, her light was shining. Her smile and good works were out there for all to see. This is Michael Gisondi with a bit of Catholic encouragement.
Hi, this is Bob Johnston. You're listening to Being Catholic right here on Catholic Spirit Radio. And we're talking about literature, what every Catholic should know from Joseph Pierce's book. And the specific topic is Cervantes, and we're talking about, of course, Don Quixote. And right before the break, we talked about the fact that Byron thought that Don Quixote sort of made any seriousness about the heroic inspirations of persons like Don Quixote simply ridiculous, and that Dostoevsky said that Don Quixote was a sad character because he shows the futility of human beings questing for, you know, greatness and justice, that it always ends up futile. And the question before the break I asked, is that true? And so we're going to go on with that and find that out. In doing so, we were talking about the fact that Dostoevsky went on and said that nevertheless, Don Quixote was a beautiful person, beautiful simply because he was so ridiculous. And that Dostoevsky wrote those words when he was beginning his own novel, The Idiot, and he was talking about the character of Prince Myshkin, who is the protagonist of The Idiot. And Prince Myshkin's transparent goodness, his lack of guile, and his noble simplicity make him an object of ridicule in the eyes of the cynically worldly, and yet evoke sympathy in those who admire his virtue and see something akin to wisdom in his innocence. It is for this reason that Sancho Panza, for all his own skepticism and jaded worldliness, is attracted to the holy foolishness of his master. Don Quixote has nothing of the rogue in him, he says. On the contrary, he could do no harm to anyone, but good to all, nor has he any malice in him. Why, a child would convince him it is night at noonday, and it is on account of that, of this simplicity, that I love him as I love the cockles of my heart, and I can't invent a way of leaving him, no matter what piece of foolishness that he does. It is therefore in this light, perhaps, that we should read Don Quixote, seeing its protagonist as a holy fool with whom we should sympathize, even when he is at his most ridiculous. And yet, there is a real danger in taking this quixotic foolishness too far. If we are not careful, we begin to see the foolishness as something which is an end in itself, as a divine madness separating faith from reason. This is a perilous path to take, leading as it does into the quagmire of the heresy of fideism, that is, in believing in faith alone. Where do we get that at? Don Quixote can lead us in this direction, seducing us to see irrational faith as preferable to rational disbelief. Or it can lead us in the opposite direction, enticing us to believe that all faith is an expression of madness, nothing but an irrational fantasy to be spurned and ridiculed. In other words, it can lead us from one extreme to the other, to declaring that faith is all we need, or on the other hand, declaring faith is ridiculous and we have to believe in the facts and material of the world. It is, however, clear that Cervantes intends to lead us in neither of these directions, both of which are inimical to the Catholic insistence on the intrinsic and indissoluble bond of faith and reason, fides et ratio, faith and reason. He leads us, in fact, to Don Quixote's conversion to the fullness of Catholic realism, philosophically understood, in which goodness is not married to madness, but in which sanctity and sanity are one and indivisible in the holy matrimony of fides with ratio. In other words, in the holy matrimony of faith and reason being married to each other, being tied to each other. In short and in sum, Don Quixote is healed of his delusions at the end of the novel, regaining his sanity, which finds full and final expression in his reconciliation with Holy Mother Church. "Blessed be the Almighty for this great benefit he has granted me," he cries in a loud voice upon awakening from sleep during his final illness. "Infinite are his mercies, and undiminished even by the sins of men." "What mercies and what sins of men are you talking about?" asks his niece. "Mercies," Don Quixote answers, "that God has just this moment granted to me in spite of all my sins. My judgment is now clear and unfettered, and that dark cloud of ignorance has disappeared, which the continual reading of those detestable books of the knight errantry had cast over my understanding. I find, dear niece, that my end approaches, but I would have it remembered that though in my life I was reputed a madman, yet in my death this opinion was not confirmed." Coming to his senses, he asks for a priest to hear his confession. The priest, after absolving him of his sins, announces that there is no doubt that he is at the point of death, and there is also no doubt that he is in his entire right mind. I was mad, Don Quixote says a little later, but I am now in my senses. In such a state of mind and in a state of grace, after he had received all the sacraments, Don Quixote breathes his last. And so this most enigmatic of novels concludes with the happiest of endings, in which the madness of life is healed by the holiest of deaths, that the final words belong to the words inscribed on Quixote's tomb. Here lies the noble, fearless knight whose valor rose to such a height. When death at last did strike him down, his was the victory and renown. He wrecked the world of little prize. That means reckoned. He reckoned the world of little prize and was a bugbear in men's eyes, but had the fortune in his age to live a fool but die a sage. So the paradox is resolved. Yes, Don Quixote lived a life of foolishness in his quest, and yes, he was very attractive in that foolishness, but Cervantes is not saying that foolishness is some kind of a great virtue that we should be following. He is saying that it was reconciled with reason, when faith and reason were finally joined in Don Quixote's mind and through the Catholic Church and through the sacrament of confession and forgiveness, then Don Quixote became whole again, and then the whole novel makes sense. It's sort of like, I would have to compare it to Gulliver's Travels. A lot of the people at the time that Jonathan Swift wrote that thought that Swift himself had gone sort of mad, because Gulliver comes back to the civilized world, comes back to England, and Gulliver is out, abandons his family and lives out in the barn talking with what he considers the innocent in horses. Winning with the horses, because Gulliver has come back from this world of the Winonyms and the Yahoos, and men were Yahoos. They were reduced to nothing but beasts, and the horses were elevated to, the kindest and nicest and wisest of animals. And Gulliver spends his time out in the barn living with the horses instead of taking care of his family. And they thought that this was what Swift meant at the ending. But to read that novel correctly, you have to see that the resolution isn't at the end of the Gulliver's Travels of the novel. It's in the return of Gulliver to England, traveling on the boat that picks him up and rescues him, and the ship's captain is actually the hero of Jonathan Swift's Gulliver's Travels, because he, if you read that, in listening to Gulliver and commenting on his travels, is the sane person. He understands, the differences between the beastly aspect of man and the good aspect of man, and understands he's a perfect Christian and actually represents Catholicism more. Swift, of course, was a Protestant, but the captain represents Catholicism. There was a lot of sympathy toward Catholicism on Swift's part. He was very much friends with Alexander Pope, who was a Catholic. And the resolution is similar to the one here in Cervantes as well. And so Cervantes is saying, when you marry faith and reason together, then the foolishness is overcome by the reason, and the reason is tempered by the foolishness, and you have the human being. And that's what we need to understand. So, on St. George's Day, 1616, Miguel de Cervantes also breathed his last on exactly the same day as the death of William Shakespeare. It was singularly and surely providentially appropriate that the brightest jewels in the golden ages of Spanish and English literature should have taken their respective last bows together. It was also singularly appropriate that these slayers of dragons, both Shakespeare with the pen is mightier than the sword, he said, and also Cervantes with both the pen and sword, because he fought with the sword in the Battle of Lepanto, that they'd taken their last bows together, that these slayers of dragons should have died on the same feast of St. George. And so, of course, St. George was the slayer of dragons, and both of these people went out and slayed huge dragons. The dragons of the persecution of Catholics by Protestants in Shakespeare's England, And, of course, the wars against Christianity in the West by the Muslims at the Battle of Lepanto and other battles. So true knights they were, who had wielded their pens like lances in the service of the good, the true, and the beautiful. So if there was the good, the bad, and the ugly, there was also the good, the true, and the beautiful. There was that balance. And what is that balance? That balance is the marriage of faith to reason. And that's why it's so important to understand that. And that's why the Pope Leo XIII and some of our other popes have always said, and I think John Paul also, that the faith that is Christianity cannot live without both. It can't fly without the wing of faith, and it can't fly without the wing of reason. Is there any comment you want to make on that, Lynn?
I think Joseph Pierce has done an excellent job with this, as evidence how much, you know, we're basing this series on. He's done so much, and your commentary, too, adding to it, it's really been great. I hadn't realized a lot of this correlation between everything. And I imagine that about our listening audience is coming to a new understanding of literature as you have had.
Well, I'm glad I was able to bring Shakespeare back to this, because I think maybe last week I, you know, got a little bit off. I was trying to emphasize the persecution that was going on in England at the time, and maybe was too broad on Shakespeare and didn't home in on him as concisely as here in this. But I knew that Cervantes here, when we talk about him, that the two are sort of married together. I mean,
yeah,
you know,
I had no idea that any of that was there. I didn't, I was an English major, I guess. Yeah. That my excuse?
But they were both taking huge risks. Fighting in that war was a huge risk. If you got captured in a war like that, I mean, sometimes, you know, you lucked out like Cervantes did the one time when he's captured by the Barbary pirates. But they were different. They were pirates, and they were, you know, their job, their business was ransoming people. Usually, you know, they would usually sell them for ransom and so forth. And so they weren't interested in torturing and doing other things to them, unless, of course, you know, they couldn't get anything for them. And so he was lucky there. But in this war, in the Battle of Lepanto, getting taken a prisoner, you know, some hugely horrible things could happen to you. And, of course, in Shakespeare days, some hugely horrible things could happen to you if you got caught being a Catholic, but especially a Catholic priest.
Right. So, and we shouldn't lose the fact that even coming into this country when it was first settled, the colonies were first settled, Christians, Catholics, not, you know, Catholics, were not welcome in all the colonies, believe me.
No, they weren't.
And you can't overlook that either, that, you know, people don't know how to reconcile their differences.
And we have to understand that Cervantes, we have to be real careful. He wouldn't, you know, having fought against the forces of Islam at Lepanto, Cervantes would not have taken lightly those works of medieval literature that sang of the epic adventures of Christian heroes such as Charlemagne, Roland, and El Cid, in the struggle against Islamic powers that had conquered Spain and were threatening the rest of Europe. Because those were the true knights and heroes, not what later became, you know, these tales later became watered down into a lot of things that were silly. And this is what Don Quixote is sort of following, you know, in the early part of his life. And Cervantes would have recognized the difference between the real tales of the real heroes, just like we recognize the difference sometimes between the real heroes in our history and sometimes how those heroes get presented as being all one-sided, you know, in later later tales about them, you know, like every flaw is wiped out and they become almost, you know, cartoonish.
Right, they're too romanticized.
They're too romanticized, mm-hmm. You know, in that word. So we have to be careful there. So when we talk about that.
And I hope this has opened up to our listening audience the gem we have here in literature. And it's not just poetry and just that on the surface. It's so deep, and how literature, stories, and so forth apply to human nature throughout all of humanity. It's very eye-opening and offers so much for us.
It does, and we want to keep the remembrance here that the two things that always have to be joined together in Christianity are faith and reason. And if reason is ever disattached from faith, which it is now a lot in our so-called secular society, when somehow reason is believed that it can fly on its own, reason becomes distorted, it becomes mean, and it often becomes cruel, and it degenerates into a paganism that can lead to disasters. It degenerates into a false anger. And remember when we started out this series, we started out with Homer, and he said, "I sing of the anger of Achilles, the devastation that it caused, and the will of Zeus, which was done." And that's pretty much like our Father prayer, "Thy will be done." In other words, "Our Father who art in heaven, right, thy will be done." So, you know, this is the theme that Homer had. You can see that the early great literature of the Greeks was moving toward Christianity. And the time was, you know, becoming ripe. When the time was ripe, when the time was right, then Christianity entered the world. And some of that great literature paved the way for it, and Christianity fulfilled it. But we can fall away. We have to remember, as Catholics, we're not automatically saved. We can fall away, and a whole culture can fall away, and good literature can make us aware of that and bring us back to our senses, and I hope that's what this is doing. Right. So, at any rate, we're going to have to stop here.
Right.
And we'll say
everybody enjoy the cooler weather. At least I do. This is my time of year. Right. I just love it.
So please pray for us. We'll pray for you.
And the world and the church.
And the world and the church, and try to keep that balance in our hearts of faith and reason. So, yeah. Saint Michael, the Archangel, defend us in battle. Be our protection against the wickedness and snares of the devil. May God rebuke him, we humbly pray. And do thou, O Prince of the heavenly hosts, by the power of God, thrust into hell Satan and all evil spirits who wander through the world for the ruin of souls. Amen.
You've been listening to Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5. If you'd like to contact Bob, email bob@catholicspiritradio.com. Again, that's bob@catholicspiritradio.com. Catholic Spirit Radio relies on your support to bring programming like this and EWTN to Central Illinois 24 hours a day. Please help keep Catholic Spirit Radio on the air with your generous support. Donate online at CatholicSpiritRadio.com or send a donation to Catholic Spirit Radio, 108 Boykins Place, Normal, Illinois, 61761. That's Catholic Spirit Radio, 108 Boykins Place, Normal, Illinois, 61761. Catholic Spirit Radio is a 501c3, and all donations are tax deductible. Thank you for your support of Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.